I wonder if you've heard the one about the three men who went out fishing on a fishing trip in their boat, and they were fishing away, when suddenly out of the sea appeared a mermaid, as they do. "Hello, boys," she said. "I'll grant you three wishes, anything you want." Now, when the men had eventually sort of recovered their composure, the first man said, I wish that I could have £1 million. And the mermaid said, "That's fine, no problem at all." And poof, there was a briefcase stuffed full of £50 notes. The second man said, "I wish that I owned my own Caribbean island." And the mermaid again said, "No problem at all, easy." Poof, there was the title deeds to his very own lovely Caribbean island. The third man thought for a bit. He thought, I wish that I was irresistible to all women. And the mermaid said, "Are you quite sure that that's what you want?" And the man thought for a bit. He thought, irresistible to all women, it'd be amazing. So he said, "No, totally sure. I wish I was irresistible to all women." "Okay then," said the mermaid. And poof, he turned into a bar of chocolate. Now this lunchtime, I'm hoping we can think about our wishes. And which are genuine wishes, and which are merely wishful thinking because they don't really exist. And specifically, I'm hoping we can see which of these two heaven falls into. Does heaven exist, or is heaven merely wishful thinking? So first of all, listen to one of the descriptions in the Bible about heaven. It says this of heaven. It says, "God himself will be with people in heaven and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from people's eyes. There'll be no more mourning or death or crying or pain in heaven." So contrary to popular portrayals, the Christian view is not that heaven is just harps and angels and fluffy clouds. Now, heaven is a place, so the Bible claims, heaven is a place of absolute perfection. Absolute perfection. Everything that is imperfect about this world will not be there. And every good thing that we have ever experienced now, it is the only the most minute taste of what can be fully experienced in heaven. So it's impossible to be bored in heaven. Now, is that just wishful thinking? Or does a heaven like that exist? Because if heaven does exist, if it exists, I think you'd agree that it's worth getting pretty excited about, and it's worth making sure we know how to get there. So how do we assess whether heaven really exists? Well, think about your answer to these two questions. Here's the first question. Do you believe that the Siberian tiger exists? Okay, it's the largest. It's also the rarest of the tiger family. Apparently, there are around 500 of them throughout the world. I wonder whether you believe it exists. That's the first question. Here's the second question. Do you believe that the Loch Ness Monster exists? It's one of the largest, one of the rarest of the monster family, apparently. Apparently, there's one of them in the world, in Loch Ness. I wonder if you believe whether the Loch Ness Monster exists. You see, to believe something exists, we either need to see it for ourselves with our own eyes, don't we? Either see it with our own eyes, or if we haven't seen it, we need to trust a reliable witness who has seen it. And that's why I believe that Siberian tiger does exist, but party pooper that I am, I don't believe that the Loch Ness Monster exists. But how about heaven? How about life after death? None of us here have seen heaven for ourselves. None of us here have died. And yet we need to work out whether heaven is like the Siberian tiger. It exists, we just haven't seen it yet. Or whether heaven is like the Loch Ness Monster, just an entertaining fairy tale. Which is it? Now, the Christian claim is that we do have a reliable witness who has seen heaven, Jesus Christ. And the Christian claim is that Jesus, he came from heaven and that he knows what happens after death because he himself, he died and he came back to life again. Jesus knows what happens after death. That's the claim. But is that claim true? Gary Habermas is a professor of philosophy and theology at one of the universities in the States, and he's widely regarded as one of the world's top authorities on the resurrection of Jesus. And he was once asked what motivated him in spending so much time and effort in researching and defending the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And this is how he replied. He said, "Every single shred of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ is also evidence for my eventual resurrection." So he's saying there that the reality of the existence of life after death, the reality of life after death, that hinges on the reality of Jesus' resurrection. But let's face it, logic tells us, doesn't it, that dead people don't rise. I mean, take my granny. She died the day before Easter this year. I was with my granny as she died. And there was nothing, absolutely nothing in me that thought she might suddenly rise to life again. Dead people don't rise. So can it really be the case that Jesus physically rose from the dead? That's the question. Let's look at the evidence. And here's the first strand of evidence, the empty tomb. The empty tomb. Now, you'll probably remember that Jesus, he was buried in a tomb which was sealed with a large boulder and it was placed under guard. That was on the Friday, and then the tomb was discovered empty on the Sunday morning. And significantly, the Bible records that it was women who found the tomb empty. Now, women had a very low status in society, in Jewish society in those days. Women were not even considered legally to be a witness in a law court. So the fact that it's recorded that it was women who found the empty tomb, it shows us that the biblical writers, they were committed to recording what happened. They weren't just making it up. They wouldn't have chosen women to find the empty tomb if they were making up the story. And even more significantly, nobody ever claimed the tomb was anything other than empty. So when the disciples said, "Look, the tomb's empty," Jesus' opponents didn't say, "Oh, no, it isn't," or, "Oh, you stupid idiots, you've just gone to the wrong tomb." No, no one anywhere in any historical record said anything other than the fact that Jesus' tomb was empty. But why was it empty? I mean, surely there are lots more plausible reasons for an empty tomb than somebody rose from the dead. So let's look at the alternative scenarios. Here's the first alternative scenario. Perhaps Jesus didn't really die. I mean, perhaps Jesus, he just sort of passed out on the cross. He was assumed to be dead, he was taken to the tomb, and then in the cool air of the tomb he revived again, and then ta-da, he appeared again. That doesn't fit the evidence. When Jesus was on the cross, having been flogged already to within an inch of his life, it's recorded that when he died, one of the soldiers came to Jesus and pierced Jesus' side with a spear, bringing a sudden flow of blood and water, a medical sign that someone is dead. But even if somehow Jesus managed to deceive everybody there that he was dead and then he was taken and placed in a tomb, even if he then managed to roll away this huge boulder from the tomb, even if he then managed to get past these Roman guards guarding the tomb, what condition do you think he would have been in when he met with his disciples? Do you think he really could have inspired them that they too, they would receive a resurrection body like his when they died? Of course not. The disciples would have just seen a bloody mess of a person. They'd have just called for a doctor as fast as possible for Jesus. Jesus didn't really die. Doesn't fit the evidence. How about this? Maybe Jesus' body was stolen. I mean, okay, you say, Jesus, he did die. I grant you that. Jesus did die, but the reason the tomb was empty was that somebody stole his body. Well, there are two possible options here. Either it could have been the governing authorities. But if it was them who stole the body, well, they would have just shown everybody Jesus' body just to prove that he was dead and sort of stop all this nonsense that Jesus had risen at once. So it can't have been them. Perhaps a more plausible option was that it was the disciples themselves who stole the body. Maybe the disciples did it. In fact, in Matthew's gospel, Matthew tells us that this was the rumor that Jesus' enemies tried to spread, that the disciples stole his body. But the fact is that the disciples, they had no motivation for doing this. They weren't expecting Jesus to rise from the dead. They had nothing to gain, everything to lose from such a hoax. I mean, if it had all been a deception, if the disciples, if they had stolen Jesus' body, surely one of them would have spilt the beans. Surely one of them would have told the truth when over the coming years they faced so much suffering and torture because they proclaimed that Jesus really had risen. And that leads us on to the third and final, and possibly, I think, the most significant bit of evidence, and this is it, the transformed disciples. Now, I have to say, personally, when I was age 17, if there was one key thing that caused me to believe in Jesus Christ, it was this: the transformation of the disciples. Just think about it for a moment. When Jesus was arrested to be taken to his death, all the disciples, they deserted Jesus. They fled. And when he died, it must have been the most confusing of times for them. This person who they'd followed, who they'd thought was the promised Messiah, suddenly he was dead. It must have felt like they'd just been duped, that they'd wasted 3 years of their life for nothing. And they were scared. They were scared witless of the authorities. We read that they were hiding behind locked doors, fearful for their own lives. And yet, something extraordinary happened to transform the disciples from quivering wrecks into fearless proclaimers of the risen Jesus. I mean, take the Apostle Peter. You'll probably remember how he denied knowing Jesus 3 times before the cock crowed. And yet 50 days later, he is preaching to over 3,000 people. And he is proclaiming, and I quote here, he proclaims, "God has raised this Jesus to life, and we are witnesses of this fact." It's quite a transformation. Or take a doubting Thomas. "Unless I see the nail marks, I will not believe," he says. And yet after he has met with the risen Jesus, he starts proclaiming about Jesus until he is killed in South India for proclaiming that Jesus is risen. In fact, so many of the disciples, they face suffering, torture, persecution, and death for their belief in the risen Jesus. So what, though? I mean, lots of people have died for what they believe. Suicide bombers, for example. Well, can you see how the disciples, they are in a completely different category, because they knew firsthand whether they had or had not met with the risen Jesus. They knew that. This was a historical fact that they had witnessed that either had or had not happened. If it was a lie, they would have known 100% it to be a lie. If it was true, they would have known 100% that it was true. Whereas suicide bombers, they just have a belief. An ideology, not a provable historical fact. Do you really think that the disciples, they would have been prepared to go to their death for something they 100% knew to be a lie? So I wonder what you make of the evidence for Jesus' resurrection. This is what a former Chief Justice of this country, Lord Darling, this is what he said about the evidence. He said, "In its favour, as a living truth, there exists such overwhelming evidence, positive and negative, factual and circumstantial, that no intelligent jury in the world could fail to bring a verdict that the resurrection is true." And because Jesus' resurrection is true, it means that we can trust Jesus about what will happen after our own death. He's been there. He has been through death. He knows what happens. And Jesus spoke of heaven and hell as real places. This means heaven is more than wishful thinking. Heaven is not like the Loch Ness Monster. Heaven is like the Siberian tiger. We haven't seen heaven yet. We haven't seen it. We haven't seen heaven, but we have a reliable witness who has and in whom we can trust. Heaven exists. And that affects us. As I said at the beginning, if heaven does exist, it's worth getting pretty excited about, and it's worth making sure we know how to get there when we die. I mean, listen to what Jesus said. This is in John's Gospel, John 11, verse 25. Jesus said this. He said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And whoever believes in me will never die." It's an absolutely outrageous claim, isn't it? Jesus is saying there that the future destiny of all of you and of me, the future destiny of everybody after our own death, it depends on whether we believe in him. "He who believes in me," says Jesus, "will live even though he dies." And so if you are not yet in a position where you believe in Jesus, and by that, Jesus doesn't just sort of mean intellectual assent. He means a willingness to trust in him as the central person in your life. If you're not yet in that position, can I just encourage you to take time to assess further the claims of Jesus? Because many people here, many people throughout the world and throughout the centuries have done that assessment and have come to the point of saying, "Yes, I can put my trust in this Jesus on whom my eternity depends." Let me finish with a quote from a guy called Lee Strobel. He used to be the legal editor of the Chicago Tribune newspaper. He's written this. He says, "The hope that Christians," so those who believe in Jesus, "the hope that Christians will overcome the grave and spend eternity with God is not the desperate longing of people too afraid to face their own mortality. Instead, it's a rational and logical conclusion based on the compelling testimony of history." Thank you for listening.